Some experts to share their views with you. So immediately to my left, your right, is Suzanne Pierce. She is a research scientist at the Texas Advanced Computing Center here at UT Austin. Then we have Kent Portney, who is the Bob Bullock Chair of Public Policy and Finance at the Bush School at Texas A&M University. And Rebecca Jordan, who is the Chair of the Department of Community Sustainability at Michigan State University. So lots of different expertise here, which was also on purpose, so that we can start to bring together diverse views. So I'm going to pose the same question to all three of you to get us started. And I purposely only said your names and your titles, because I'd like to hear your own words as to how you view urban sustainability. What is urban sustainability from your perspective?
I think we start with you.
All right.
You got the mic.
I got the mic. Is it on?
Ooh.
Yeah. Okay. So I see it through the lens of combinatorial optimization. So they're multi-attributed and multi-objective problems that are in a multi-dimensional decision space that even the simplest of problems exceed our human ability to exhaustively search and discover all of the solutions without the aid of a computer. So we need the computational support in order to identify effective and feasible solutions. But I also see that underpinning that is you always have to have human-computer interaction, and so without the contextualization of our insights, and more importantly, the insights of the people who are on the ground that have and own the problems, we won't be able to pose useful and relevant questions, and so we won't be able to find useful or relevant solutions. In some cases, you don't need the computers to solve the problem for you. You just need them to help you to inspire dialogue, and hopefully then if you are able to transfer that dialogue into a deliberation where you're actually talking through how to make a choice, it's possible that the compute systems can help you better understand the unexpected responses in your system. So I see computing and humans kind of mutually linked in a participatory interaction.
I've been working on sustainable cities issues since 1999. I say that for two reasons. One is to tell you that I'm older than most of you. And the other is I've probably been working on some aspects of this longer than most of you.
Feels like a challenge.
That's right. I have a particular perspective on this, which is I'm interested in the policies and programs that we adopt and implement in our efforts to try to become more sustainable. I don't get hung up on the idea that cities are not sustainable. I'm interested in doing what I can to do research to contribute to understanding how we can move cities toward becoming more sustainable. And I think that's the spirit in which NSF is approaching this urban sustainability initiative. My latest challenge, again consistent with, I think, with the NSF report, is that I don't think we have very good measures of sustainability that can be used at appropriate levels or scales for governance. What I mean by that is I need data about cities proper, because that's a governmental jurisdiction that makes decisions. I need data at the county level. I need data at the special district level. I need data at some regional levels, state levels, and that sort of thing. I also need data at scales and geographic areas that you're familiar with, river basins, aquifer areas, to understand how the city governance jurisdictions are related to the biophysical environment. And I'll just say one more word about this, and that is, I know we're supposed to talk a little bit about big data.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I have come to the conclusion that big data, at least as we have it today, as we understand it, is not very useful for the kind of thing that I do. I want it to be more useful, but it's been about 6 or 7 years ago now. I worked with the UCalWater water data. I took a deep dive into their data, which at the time I thought was probably the best big data we had, or included the best big data we had about water. And I found that there was literally nothing in any of their data. I was lucky because UCalWater was located down the street from where I was, so I could work with their staff. And we came away and said, you know, the way we store this, what the information we have, we can't help you with what you need. Well, I'm not sure things have changed very much. I haven't done any deep dive since then, but it's got to change. We've got to find a way to connect big data to the things that we need to know to make good decisions at the city level, the county level, the special district level, and so on. Thanks.
Well, I kind of thought we'd sit up here and sort of say very similar things, and now I realize that you've done an excellent job. We are
very good data.
Is there convergence?
We don't need those.
Yes. We are divergent.
Yes, right. For example, you say, I view urban sustainability maybe much like what you think about sustainability. We want enough in perpetuity, I guess that goes without saying. For me, urban centers represent complex systems. These systems are social and ecological in nature. A goal, or maybe myself and many others who think about these things with me, is to think about how these systems could become resilient, and in particular, a type of resiliency that manages the environmental as well as the human capital such that we can keep these things going well into the future, and that there are certain things we want to see maximized. It's our choice, like human well-being, you know, a certain aesthetic value, as well as the environment and ecosystem services that are involved in these systems. And so from that perspective, I think very much about participatory, I think very much about sort of everyone being involved. To me, big data presents this opportunity for individuals to contribute to a very large data set. I think the issue has been that the scale has often been too coarse. And I think a way to get these data to a much finer scale, a much finer grain, is to engage people. And so I think these are these wonderful opportunities where each individual has this potential to contribute to these data sets to give us an opportunity to test ideas. I noted that in so many situations, it seems like we're applying data that were gathered somewhere else. You know, maybe it's the Netherlands, maybe it's just simply somewhere else, and then trying to apply it to these urban situations. I recently read about trees, right, sequestering carbon in an entirely different way in cities than how anybody would have sort of predicted. And to me, and maybe it's my biological background and the fact that I've always worked with humans and animals, but trees, we should know about trees. We should have had that down. Like, they're just not that complex compared to other things. And so the fact that trees continue to surprise us tell me we're missing something. We've really got to be looking at these things in situ. And so that, to me, is urban sustainability.
This is great. I'm jotting down like 4 additional questions just from this introduction. So,
back to you.
Yeah, I don't want to monopolize all of the time, but because I'm your moderator, I'm totally going to ask my own question. So one of the things that you touched on here is data, and there are a whole bunch of opinion papers out there that will tell you data are fantastic, but data on their own are not really useful. And perhaps what we are missing is the bridge between sensing of data and actually making sense of data. And there are a whole bunch of ways in which we could do that, but I'm wondering if any of you from your expertise can lend kind of best practices, or Suzanne, you mentioned human-computer interaction, and that's very different than
how do we make sense from data about trees that are related to humans? So I'm wondering if you can share some perspective on making sense of data.
So one of the things that has come through and continues to come through, and I think it's starting to really ring in my ears, is this idea of implementation science. And so we, through a project here that's funded at UT called Planet Texas 2050, which I think a lot of you know about and heard about, we're actually trying to design and implement the cyber infrastructure and the ecosystem that can handle not only the data, but also, of course, the metadata about that data, and also the interfaces that allow non-computational or people who aren't, researchers and even just stakeholders who are non-academics, access to the larger computing systems. And under the covers, so on the surface, that's all conceptually simple. As we are going through and designing this thing, I keep finding all kinds of issues, because it literally goes, our system goes from the hardware all the way out to how do you get this information into a HoloLens or an augmented reality modality, so you can deliver it to kids and people who need that kind of more immersive and corporeal experience. That corporeal, that sounds like punishment.
It does.
Anyway, sorry.
Data science is the new punishment.
Yeah, data science is punishment for most of us. It really is. But so trying to figure out how to do that, you start to find the gaps and the problems. I've been referring to it as faceted frameworks, that I go and talk to one person and they tell me how they see the world, and I have to go and try and incorporate that knowledge into the way we're designing the system so it has the features that can meet them where they are. Or on the computing side, I have to go and talk to the computer scientists who are like, I don't care about your problem. I don't care about the trees. I need GPUs. And I'm like, what the heck is a GPU? So you have to figure out, like, what's a GPU? And how do you install it in a computer? And then why do I want a GPU? And how do I make sure that the GPU is available to somebody studying trees that doesn't want to learn about GPUs, so that we can accelerate the visualization so they can see them without lag, right? All of these weird things that you're finding. So this ability to kind of dive in, it's been really nice because Planet Texas gives us this concrete need to implement, so it's driving the conversations that we have to have. And they're not all nice and fluffy and fun. There have been a lot of really surprising moments where you realize organizationally, things aren't working at TAC where I am, or they're not working at UT on campus, or so. I talked way too long.
Right. My take on this is that we spend way too much time talking about the means, and not enough time talking about the ends. A lot of the computational stuff is about means to get to some end, and I'm never quite sure what the end is. And unless we have that explicit discussion, we can't make judgments about the efficacy of what we're doing on the means. If I think about the data issues, the thing that I struggle the most with is developing standardized, understood measures of sustainability outcomes, is what I call them, for cities or other jurisdictions. I know that I want to measure 100 different dimensions or characteristics of cities' sustainability, a sustainability state at a given time, and to measure how it's changed over time. I've got no data to measure most of those things. There are some areas where we've done better than others. We've talked about things like adaptive management, which is extraordinarily important. That's a means to an end. And I'm not sure what end it actually produces, and I can't be sure about that in any generalizable way unless I've got measures of those, of the outcomes we're trying to achieve. So I keep coming back to the idea that for me, the key dependent variables in all my analysis have to do with sustainability outcomes. What is the water quality? What is the air quality? What is water accessibility? 100 different measures of outcomes that I'd like our governments to make decisions to improve, right? But I don't know what those outcomes are. I can't measure those outcomes, even for one point in time, for most places in the country. So that's my.
I heard two things that really sort of resonated with me. One, sort of more recently, is this idea of perhaps time lag scale, you know, and that we can think about, I think sustainability is one of those things where we kind of know it when we see it. We kind of recognize it when we're pretty far along, if we're trying to sort of gear ourselves toward it. We don't have enough of these sort of intermediate measures, these early measures that we know will somehow be associated with these latter measures that we're really targeting. And so it's just kind of trying to understand these little metrics as they pertain to that impact that's just so far down the road. And that's a real challenge when stakeholders have so many different needs to kind of try to get people on the same page with some of these things. And then sort of the other piece of that is when thinking about some of these HCI interactions and what we need to be doing. You know, my experience, I've worked with two design teams, one at Georgia Tech, one at Colorado State, to try to create simple software, I called it, for members of the public to use. And the amount of time, the amount of issues, it was just not sustainable, for lack of a better word, to think about how we design these things to be generalizable, right? We ultimately just had to say, put together something, use in this context, we're kind of late in the game here. And so I got to think simple is better. I got to think that we need to start coordinating these metadata standards. I've been through meeting after meeting where people are discussing them, and yet nobody can come to a decision. And when they do, part of the room still sits there and advocates for their own idea and do it anyway. And so this sort of lack of cooperation and coordination, I think, is really hurting us in the long run. I'm not sure the public yet believes that these things need to be solved, and they needed to be solved yesterday. And so my ideal would be that sort of every member of the public would somehow be involved in this process and would contribute something to a very simple interface that then can be mined by them, by municipalities, by, you know, large governments, and make that open and free access. The steps to that is going to take coordination and cooperation that I just don't see the will yet. I don't see the desire. I think when that hits, if it hits, things, amazing things are going to happen quickly. But at this point, we just don't, I just don't see the will among the public, among decision makers. And it really, I think, is a huge roadblock that maybe doesn't need to be so big.
So let's talk about that while you've got the microphone. Let's talk about how we move forward, because we could sit here and argue about how to define sustainability, and that's honestly one of my least favorite topics to talk about. Because we all, like you've all said, we have this kind of gut feel for something that's more sustainable than something else. But then you pointed out metrics are hard, and having data behind those metrics are hard. So let's just table that and agree that it's a thing, but we'll move beyond that. And we're all coming from university perspectives, from academic perspectives, and I did that on purpose because our goal in all of this workshop, is to get to a white paper for NSF, but long term, as Jay said, is a research program and some sort of fundable, tractable project. So how do we do that from your perspective? How do we get from this long-term stakeholder engagement challenge to something that is actually doable in a research project context? How do you see, based on what we've said and discussed in the workshop, how do you see that getting scoped and actually paired into something doable?
Congratulations.
If I knew, I think that we'd be in a different place right now. No, I think we've got to really start thinking about pushing boundaries
I think academics sort of writ large promotes a somewhat selfish perspective, and that's how we get promoted, and then when we get promoted, we just keep along these tracks. And I often will, when I am planning research projects, think about what the fundable project is, but think about the project as it moves beyond funding, and realizing it doesn't need to be done for the project. You have to think about resources, and often we have to donate our own time to that. But I argue we're very good at, you know, spending a lot of time with something as academics, so why not just spend a little more? I think we really need to start pushing the boundaries. You know, NSF is funky to some degree, that they have to take these kinds of risks that are under scrutiny, and that makes it difficult for them. So in a sense, when I think about submitting an NSF proposal, I'm like, well, I've got to demonstrate it'll definitely work, but yet I've got to demonstrate that it's transformative and novel and you know, risky in the same time. And so we need to think about maybe like investment portfolios and how we plan and scope these things out so that you are maintaining a certain level of, here, we promise to deliver this and this is going to be good no matter what, with a sense of, this is an area we don't know, we're just trying it, if it fails miserably, that's fine. You know, so that way we can move forward and push boundaries and envelopes and really start thinking about things in ways that maybe we haven't, because as we think about how to move forward, it's going to take a little creativity, and we need lots of people in the room. I think participatory methods are valuable. I think trying to do things in the absence of the people who are going to be affected is just going to result in a product that isn't going to be used anyway. So might as well do the hard work up front, might as well get the stakeholders involved up front, you know, and sort of maintain these multiple tracks like an investment portfolio so that you are delivering at what you need, but also trying to get at something that we haven't quite thought about before. And again, my gut tells me it's going to be in these sort of novel partnerships between industry, between the public, between, you know, governance, between, you know, these sort of pseudo nonprofit yet for profit interactions that are going to result in the resources and the staying power to go beyond what it is we have funding for. And so if we can get that going and get people excited enough, at least in a model, in a small scale, then maybe we can get the right people to pay attention. And I really like thinking about resilience in a way that does focus on a tangible local system, but always has its arms out so that way if system, you know, collapse is imminent, there's sort of a lifeline. But yet if that lifeline's cut, you're still got what you need on the inside. So I think a lot of these things are going to be unique partnerships, unique balances, and just getting, you know, and help, having the public help, I think, is something I found surprisingly useful. That people, you know, without college degrees in science are capable of analyzing data and capable of making decisions based on those data. It's a matter of just bringing it to them. It's a matter, they're really good at it, and, you know, I've done a lot with citizen science. When there's a problem they really want to solve, when you have them collecting things about butterflies and birds, if they're a really motivated hobbyist, it's great. If they're not, they don't really do such a great job. And I think people sort of look at that information, those data, and say, oh, they can't. But I think we're forgetting cases where people are really, they have a stake and they really care. And then you look at what they come up with, and then you see, wow, you know, that these people are very capable of being partners as much as industry and government partners can be.
I like the investment portfolio analogy.
So as Rebecca was speaking, actually, I just had this great aha moment, like, oh my God, that's what we should do in our proposal to NSF. We should start doing this in all our proposals. How can I redefine my entire research program?
So Jay's ready to take notes, I can
which
tell.
Is,
Well, I'm not this idea.
The idea of, like, let's think of three things. Let's think about the tractable, we know we can get this done thing. then let's think about that middle ground, kind of a bit more of a reach, and then let's have some like crazy come up with the like composable fractals, like something like, what the heck are you even thinking about, like, you know, that big reach idea, like, and put things so that way we get to have those really high risk exploratory things embedded inside and grounded on top of these other things that we know we can do, that maybe aren't going to have that real transformational approach. And then the other thing I was, you said a lot of things, but I had notes and I'm not paying any attention to anything I thought I was going to say. I think, so, a couple of the things that Rebecca said. So, and I'll draw on a project that I worked on for many years that took a long time. So I've been engaged, and I said something about this yesterday too, that in my career, I think I'm going to be able to engage in somewhere between 3 to, if I'm lucky, maybe 7's a really big reach, good projects, right? Because I believe in, I look at the world through, well, I believe in computing as a necessary thing that we have to develop and the critical path in many respects. I also think that the only change comes through relational interactions. So it's only through relation that we really see. So I look at, analytically, I see things through a systems lens, and then relational is really the approach to making transformative change. And I'll use whatever tool I need, and data's not getting, we haven't contextualized it enough yet. So one of the projects I've worked on for now over 20 years is in the Andes in Chile. And I work with an indigenous community. I work with the Linkanantay, which is near San Pedro de Atacama in the Atacama Desert. And what Rebecca was talking about was, like, everything you said, I was like, yeah, it's very true, because it was a co-design project. My close interactions with the Linkanantay leaders began after a geothermal incident at a geothermal energy location in the Andes, and it required interactions between the mining companies, the energy companies, and the indigenous communities. And so my big idea and a Fulbright that I went on was to go down and build all the data, which we did, and bring it to them in a repository, and I delivered it with a natural user interface. So I took a huge touchscreen down and worked with these indigenous communities. And it took me 4 years before I could get there with the touchscreen. And for 4 years, I said, we really need to go and talk to the mining communities. And the answer was no, we're going to talk amongst ourselves. And there was one man in particular that I know could not read. And when I arrived with the touchscreen, there were a lot of observations. One was, it was their data that they told me they wanted. And up to that point, they'd always asked me to be their expert and like explain things to them. When I showed up with the touchscreen, I couldn't get them off of it. First, they looked at it like it was an adder that was going to bite them, but then also, they all like kind of gathered around it and were just like, you know, they were exploring their world and their data, like the back of their hand, and all of a sudden it was, how fast can we get in there to talk to those miners? Like, let's go, bring it. So we did, we brought it. And what I discovered was, corporations don't have an identity that can actually negotiate with these groups when they're ready. So I hate to say it, I'm not so confident about the corporate partnerships, because I haven't seen corporations be able to find a way to play at that table.
And I should say, for-profit and corporate are not necessarily the same.
Yeah,
and so I think corporate's the last one that gets on board once the trend is set, but for-profit entities maybe could be.
The other thing I saw was the technology helped them leapfrog more quickly towards discussions, and identity reared its ugly head again because they leapfrogged, and out of this we got a nonprofit, which is a micro-entrepreneurial nonprofit run by the indigenous women's group in San Pedro de Atacama, and they funded several groups, and that still lives today and is doing well. It resulted in a founding of a global 3D printing company that's industrial scale. I was one of the co-founders. That still lives on today and is doing quite well. It also resulted in the co-founding of an indigenous mining partnership to build a renewable energy plant that would be owned and operated by the indigenous community, and they would have contracts with the mining company at a set price that assured that the business model would work. That died, and here's why. Because the technology leapfrogged the conversation and the dialogue at a pace that was faster than the identities could actually keep up. And it threatened the identity of those leaders. And so there are all kinds of questions about how does technology help us? How can we contextualize our information better so we can leapfrog faster because we need to? And what are the barriers to that are going to cause failure when we think we've had success?
Ashlyn raised the issue of stakeholder research, stakeholder engagement. And we've talked an awful lot about that over the last couple of days. I've been doing stakeholder engaged research and community engaged research, which is not the same, for a long time. And the one thing I would say about it is they're not. You have to be very clear about why you're doing it in the first place, what you're trying to get out of it, what purpose the stakeholder engagement is serving, because it may serve some purposes way better than others. If you're, for example, if you want to know what people say they would like, what kind of research they would like, what kinds of data they would like, they can tell you that. And unfortunately, what that means is that when you get your results and present it to them, they're going to say, I don't really want that anymore. Sometimes it's an effort to understand how to be more responsive to particular groups of people. It's a very different issue in terms of providing benefits to those people. And sometimes you don't need to have the engagement to do that kind of research, but it certainly helps. And sometimes it helps us understand impacts of things that we don't necessarily know how to get at. So if you, especially when it comes to co-production of benefits, we often talk about efforts in public policy to provide co-benefits. And sometimes we think we're providing benefits to people, and we ask them about it, they say, no, that's terrible. I don't want that. That's bad for me. And sometimes we need to know that from people before we can internalize that. And I would say, though, that in much of our research, we end up confronting dilemmas, various kinds of dilemmas. There are those people who love dilemmas, and those people whose heads explode when they face dilemmas. I have both of those things. I think with stakeholder engagement and participatory research, you're going to find a lot of dilemmas that you just can't resolve. You do the best you can.
Can I just add very quickly, when you mentioned they got the iPad and then they started sort of being involved, one of the things that I found in participatory decision making, right, is you decide a process, you go through all this, here's this rational choice, and then people look at it, and I've had this happen in numerous occasions, and go, so it does help to remind when I'm working with groups of people, you know, we maybe aren't the most rational decision makers as a collective. We make decisions all the time at split seconds. This is what we do. That's fine. It's great for us. But I have had to embed sometimes sort of a third party to, here's where we're going to go through this process. We're going to agree on the process, right? We're going to agree on that. And then when the decision is made and this points to a rational direction, we can all agree to that. We're going to promise to have this third party sort of identify that and at least put us in a direction of giving it a try. Because if I don't have that, you know, and I was really pleased that your individual said, let's contact the minors, because in many cases, I've had things where they're like, okay, never mind. I'm going to go to the gut feeling that I had when I started and that I just sort of engaged in this process as an amusement to you and others when it really isn't embedded.
So I hope you all have questions brewing. I have one more hard question, and then I'll let them ask hard questions. So let's make believe, just go with me on this. Let's make believe that we have got sufficient funding for all of these super cool research projects.
That's
I said make believe. Just roll with me here. So we've got sufficient funding. We've designed the research. You've got the mic now, so you're not the What does success look like? How do we know we were successful? And we've already landed the funding, so we got funding is not the correct answer here. There is no correct answer, but that's not the answer.
Kumbaya.
We
break into a musical.
How do we know? Like, we put all this effort in, and then how do we know that right there was a successful project?
I guess the only way I can answer that is with my blinders on, right? If I can do a piece of research that gives what I would consider to be valid, generalizable results, so that I can tell the mayor of a city, if you do X, you're going to produce these benefits for these people, and the benefits are sustainability. That is, we've protected and improved the biophysical environment while we've grown the economy and we've improved equity. If we've done those three things, if I can do a piece of research that gives me definitive answers on how to do that, I'm success. I consider that a success. I'm not holding my breath.
You know, there's a sort of personal level of success, and then maybe a more global level of success that, to me personally, if I ended up with something that I'm like, I got to tell someone about this, you know, that's very exciting to me, and it doesn't happen as often as I'd like. When something comes out of this that's just totally not the way we thought about something and it can be productive, then that's really great. I am not an extraordinarily optimistic person by nature, and so, you know, if we don't entirely fail, then that's also success. And so, to some degree, you know, you live to fight another day.
Yeah.
We got the money already.
You know, you live to fight another day, then that's also success. I think to some degree, you know, I've seen things take a long time to build and take a long time to work well, and then take like an hour and a half to be destroyed. And so I gotta believe there's something in how we duplicate function, or in some way to not endure collapse. When something gets destroyed, then we're successful. And I would hope with infinite amount of money, we can embed these kinds of redundancies in a system to enable it to be resilient, yet still have this piece of resilient systems that we often don't even think about, which is the capacity to sort of invent and do more, you know. And so if we can manage both of those, then we're looking pretty good. And that just gets defined differently by the human capacity in front of you. And that changes even with time, with a new generation, with a new board, with a new group. And so if we have processes, and again, you know, thinking about sort of Barack Obama's quote that I really can't re-quote, but that this kind of arc of history, right, it is sort of wide and it sort of bends towards progress, but it takes these, you know, I think sort of I'll take any measure of progress and say, hey, you know, NSF, funding agency, whatever, we're good. And if we can sort of keep it going roughly in that direction, then I'm happy. So that's the pessimistic view on all of this.
I like that as academics, we hear sufficient funding and we say infinite funding.
Yes. I guess what I'm saying is sufficient funding, did you catch that, is infinite.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's sort of
What does success look like, Susanna?
Well, so again, I have some notes. With technology projects, frequently there's this likelihood that people who use your technology or interact with your model will come back after they've interacted with it and say, well, they'll have an aha moment, and in the moment they'll realize they had an aha moment, and then afterwards they'll assimilate that kind of into their belief system or into their kind of recognition of how the world works, and you'll ask them, was that useful? And they'll say something to the effect of like, yeah, it kind of confirmed what I already knew, because they kind of forget that they didn't know. So finding a way to help capture, so cohesively capture both when we're able to help make a leap forward, which is really hard to figure out how to do, and then to cohesively connect across this group so that, as Rebecca alluded to earlier, we can transcend the selfish gene that is academic life, so that we can actually work more to support our colleagues in their vision as well, right? So one of the things that I've started doing when I compose workshops, and this is an awesome workshop, by the way, and y'all are fantastic participants. This has been a really good group. But when I am composing it a lot for this other community that I am the PI for, we always actually try to get kind of the supporters, we call them. And these are the people that don't have those star academic records, that don't have all the publications, because they're the people that are behind the scenes that are actually helping lift and float the boats. They're the people that are openly sharing ideas, usually, and delivering those ideas in different ways, right? There are a lot of these people in the academy that don't get invited to these workshops often because they don't have the star quality CVs, and they are the reason that these kinds of ideas actually work. And what I've found is if you can figure out who those people are and start including them in your interactions, all of a sudden, things start really gaining tractability and moving forward. And NSF has observed some of these workshops, and they're like, how did you do that? And we're like, we just got a different group of people that were, so we had this mix of personalities of people that some are the doers, and they're not going to be the typical people you would expect to be on the team. So I've looked for diversity across the team in all aspects, career level, gender, you know, just everything, race, everything. But also add to that diversity this idea of the alternative performance researchers. The other thing that I wanted to make sure that I mentioned is when we walk into, so success group two, because it's relational, would be when you walk into a room, your prior collaborators come over. I'm a hugger. So if I get a hug, I'm like, dude, I so totally rocked this. I scored it. So but when you see happiness on your collaborators' faces, that they're really happy that you're there, that the city folks are happy to see you, or in my case, when I go back to Chile, I've been invited to climb the Linkancabur volcano, which is very exciting, and it means I'm in the spiritual in crowd. Which is really nice.
Doesn't mean they want to sacrifice me.
I don't think it means they're going to sacrifice me, but they might not tell me that. They might not tell me that up front. So that, and then also seeing kind of the paradigm shift and new frameworks that help us inform generalized knowledge in use and applied in, you know, the places where we live and the places where we collaborate.
Hang on to the mic. What questions do you all have? We've got 15 or so minutes. Yes?
I have a question for Suzanne. You mentioned optimization. Mm-hmm. Is there a trade-off between optimization and resilience? Detroit was highly optimized for auto production and made it very non-resilient.
Oh, I love that question. Yeah, so I actually think, so I said optimization. So I think of it more as a meta-heuristic search technique. So I think about it in terms of identifying possible alternatives or candidate solutions. And then I think about using optimization, not to find an actual optimal solution in terms of mathematically or performance-wise even, but I think of it more as a technique to identify the solution space that is feasible, and then to work with stakeholders within that space to identify what is satisficing, so kind of what's inside that negotiation space that can connect us between, you know, you want no pumping and protect the endangered species with very restrictive kind of flow requirements,
I want to develop a city aggressively, well, I mean, that sounds negative. I want to develop a beautiful, thriving city for the future, and that's going to require the use of these resources. And so somewhere between, we're gonna have to use a lot of water and you don't get to use any water because it needs to be preserved for ecosystems, there's a, what are our options in between? And so I like to use, that's where I say, I believe in human in the loop. I don't think that machines are gonna solve the problems for us. So I think that the leveraging those machines to actually help us refine the space where we need to negotiate and identify, do we have a real impasse or are we just bogged down in uncertainty? I wanna get away from position-based negotiations and move more towards principle-based dialogue and deliberation and leverage the optimization approaches to identify where unexpected solutions might lie that we're not, that we can't see without that aid. I call it a macroscope. We're building a micro, you know, microscopes help us see things, sorry, I'm talking too much, can I just, so I call it a macroscope. Microscopes and telescopes help us see things and identify and understand things that we can't see without the aid of a piece of equipment. The cyber infrastructure is the macroscope that's helping us to identify these complex patterns and solutions that we can't find without the aid of a tool.
Do I have a question?
Yeah, so I'd like to follow up on Ashley's last question for you guys. What does success look like? Right? Rebecca, you told us we came up with something novel that we're so busted, just have to go tell someone about it. It's awesome. Kent, you said, well, I could tell the mayor if you do this and this positive outcome will happen for the triple bottom line. Great. Suzanne, you said, in a general way, if the stuff we're doing is put into use by practitioners. And so for me, that kind of scaled up to like where I think we can be and where to me, what really resonated is that for a proposal. Research or program or direction or themes, whatever you want to call it, that the stuff that is done by this program is actually being used. And so what I'd like to do is with this group here, which is both people on the academic side, operations side, utilities, practitioners, to look around the room, what a great mix of both sides of that. I guess I'd like to put that question out there. Can we be more specific about that? What would that look like? The practitioners, the stakeholders, using the results of whatever was co-designed. Are there some tangible things that you feel like would be, no-brainer, hey, you do this, this is really success, and something maybe a little beyond what we already see, so that it does look like a frontier way to go on as Antonia.
Yeah, so that really resonates with me, because I thought, if I were a taxpayer listening to your description of what success is, I would say, why?
Wait, you mean hugs doesn't cost money? Or sacrifice at the top of a volcano?
That's one of those dilemmas I was talking about.
And so, I mean, what if we defined success in a very pragmatic and very applied way and said, okay, we probably already have enough data to know that climate change is bad and what needs to happen in some way or form to prevent this from continuing to happen. What if the goal was to say, well, the city of Austin, in their KPIs, and they have sustainability goals, and they have three pragmatic key performance indicators that we know are scientifically sound. They are pragmatic because it's based on data that they can generate or already have, and they manage the city against those KPIs. That's implementable, and that has real world impact. And if we build research around, okay, back end, what does the user need in order to be able to manage those systems, and then we do all the research to give people the right metrics and the right way of measuring this, and take more of a design thinking approach in, mm-hmm. in this.
I would absolutely agree. I think success can be moderate in that way. I think one thing that I like to do myself is, because I'm working with often members of the public, is I look at the capacity. I'd like to define capacity very clearly and then say, have we increased capacity, and some of that has to do with certain knowledge metrics and mental models and things that kind of go beyond just your simple test, as well as looking at what people are kind of doing differently now that they hadn't before. When it comes to decision and decision making, you know, I like to keep it, cast a wide net to say, what are they doing now as a result of this project? Where do those rest? We can set a goal of 3 KPIs, we're gonna do that, but if we don't hit that, we're still in a place where we can be, where we can say this is a success, this is getting us closer to where we need to be. And so I'm very careful about putting really excellent, optimal goals, but also saying, hey, success looks like this, this, and this, and here's how we know that. And I think sometimes we want to look at these tangibles that they walk away from, and then we want to call things not successful when they don't, but that we forget that there's a lot that goes on in the middle that gets us to where we need to be. So let's set up our projects in a way to pick up on that, so that way we at least, with our next shot, get a little bit closer. Because I do think, again, talk about shot, this is like a kind of a moonshot level problem. But we know we took people standing on Earth doing practically, you know, nothing. I don't know what people did on Earth in 1960, but just kidding. But so then, like, to 1969, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the point is, like, in what, like 8-9 years, they managed to shoot people literally to stand on the moon. That was an amazing, if you looked at the capacity where they started and where they ended, it was an amazing feat. But I think it was because each iteration brought them closer to goal. If we could do that with like sustainability, I mean, imagine, again, the moon, like what was the point of that? But like to get, you know, cities sustainable, now that's a real moonshot goal that I think we really want to hit those pieces.
Sometimes it's hard to measure what counts, but yeah, we can certainly count things that we do measure.
Let me pick up on the climate change. You chose to use that. I would love to be able to tell a mayor or other policymaker that if you pursue this program and do it seriously, fund it well, and so on, not infinitely, that you will reduce your carbon dioxide emissions in the city. We have lots of programs that cities do with the assumption that it's going to have that impact. We don't know, in most cases, we don't know whether it's had that impact or not, because we don't have good measures of carbon emissions in cities. Where we do, cities sometimes know that, and they really won't share that with you, right? Anu Ramaswamy, who's one of the principal authors of that report we've been referring to, has said over and over again, 90% of the programs that cities pursue with the expectation of producing benefits don't produce those benefits at all. Well, that's a problem. If we have government doing things they're thinking they're producing results and they're not producing, that's wasteful if nothing else. It becomes much more complicated when you are trying to optimize goals rather than just achieve a single goal. So if you're trying to reduce your carbon without destroying your local economy, that's an optimization problem, writ large. How do we do that? We don't know. We just don't know yet because we haven't done the complex research that we're going to need to do to answer that.
Quick response and then a couple of hands back here. And Moira.
Super quick. I think I'm aligned with this. So one thing that I do think is this whole idea of metrics and how do we measure success and also, again, I go back to relationship building will make us more resilient. And in my doctoral work, we looked at Barton Springs here in Austin. And one of the key indicators that our stakeholders that we worked with, they requested indicators for spring flow because they were worried about the salamander. They were worried about recreational value. They were worried about water quality, blah, blah, blah. They had a bunch, you know, with six sub-objectives that we created around that and decision problem formulations. The thing that was really interesting to me was how I built the metric determined what the policy recommendation was. Exactly. And so how I measured spring flow, you know, imagine a probability of instantaneous flow versus an average monthly value or maximize the minimum spring flow over a 10-year time horizon changed what my policy recommendation would be at the far end of the analysis. We never got to talk about that with the stakeholders. We just said, here you go, we're gonna optimize spring flow. Is that good? Yes. Does that reflect your concern? Yes. Awesome. It's in the model. And we never, I wanna go back and like have those conversations like, what's the better representation of your metric?
I think that feedback loop, like, I think really important, and I think that's something to pick up on. Like what universities can bring, as Danny said this earlier, is a really long-term kind of consistent refining of understanding what affects what. And the partners would be mayors, and mayors are always wanting to get together. I've been involved in different scales of regional development and neighborhood stuff, and they'll always get together, but their KPIs change. Every election,
of course,
every election it shifts, and if the legislature does something, it shifts. But universities can provide a consistent, constantly rigorous modeling that keeps getting refined going forward. That could be taken all the way down to the community level, the neighborhood level, which is where the fundamental unit, I think, of human collective responsibility and decision making at its best is neighborhood. Or village, whatever you want to call it. And we have a ton of data at that scale, right? Utility records and all this stuff that doesn't get brought out and used for anything. But that may be where this proposal or this kind of idea might find some interest is take MSAs, metropolitan statistical areas, so you got several cities intimately related to each other with workforce, with water, with all that stuff, but really hard time getting along. Or making any kind of consistent decisions that affect that benefit everybody. But you could bring a modeling approach to that that is politically neutral. And I'm thinking of the panel yesterday, and I feel Chris's pain and Sarah's, that the politics of it doesn't care if there's a model or not, or how good it is, or which metric is in there. But universities could provide a stable, consistent, well, you tried that. Everybody thought those 90% of those programs, they were all the best idea.
That's right.
At the point that they were passed and adopted. And the university could say, all right, we'll just keep measuring how that works. And then ideally you can be measuring forward or refining progressively, which is what all neighborhoods do.
Mackenzie,
do
you have a question?
Yeah, I was gonna come from the perspective of someone who's been a sustainability coordinator, and I've been working within some of these frameworks that they do have some loose outcomes and some measurements, but there's really no way for me to tell whether or not they're actually impactful. And I think that we were kind of getting to this point. And so to Jay's question, what would be beneficial for someone like me if I were working in city government is to look at a lot of these existing frameworks that cities are already using. So like City of Austin uses their STAR Communities guide to become a more resilient city. They're trying to measure themselves within these frameworks, and they're using things that already exist. And I can't tell, and I've never been able to tell whether or not they actually work or they're effective or they will be effective long term. And having some sort of research that backs those up, and there is some, but it's not to the level I think that folks like you would bring to its legitimacy. There's some international frameworks around, like your Mercy Corps, that is really focused on getting communities to work together around resilience, and it's all around self-governance and things like that. So, you know, they're being adopted widely, so to what extent are they effective? And if we're already using them, cities are already using them, can we legitimize them in some way? That would be, as a practitioner, that's my practitioner hat.
This is all great stuff, and remember, we're putting all of this together into an outline for a white paper. So just because we're running out of time doesn't mean that you can't voice your perspective. Moira's hand was up.
Don't
and then
now,
how are we doing? How do you want to handle this, Jay? Do you want to cut it off and then pick up again?
I would just, since we've heard from a couple of practitioners, now I'd like to keep hearing from them, because I feel like their voice.
I see three
really
hands.
So we have Peter, we have Joe.
Moira had her hand up.
I have a practitioner comment too.
Okay. Go ahead, Moira.
So I don't want this to come off as self-serving at all. I'm learning a ton of all of you scientists, and it's a very unique window in the world. I feel like a cultural anthropologist has been dropped into this series. I didn't really give a full introduction when we did our yarn thing, but I worked for Gensler, and it's a 6,000 person firm with 50 offices all over the world. We touch about 1 billion square feet every year. And within our organization, we have all these sustainability initiatives. And I can tell you that everyone in, almost everyone in the architectural profession is just trying to make the world a better place. And yet everything that we do in a lot of ways negates that. Anytime we build anything. And so one of my huge frustrations with the firm is, even if we could make every project that we did lead platinum, even if you could mandate that every project everywhere was lead platinum, we are still in the world of hurt. And so I don't know how we can help as an organization or whether we could partner with science, but I'm just offering it. We have a platform that exists all over the world, touches about 1 billion square feet a year, and through a really intelligent way. It's going to be messy. I mean, anything like that's messy because you've got so many different players involved on the private side. But the offering, I think, is that, or the opportunity is that you have, you can do very controlled, kind of isolated experiments. A lot of my projects are measured in this sort of 100-acre-ish area. So they're not at the scale of the city, but they're at a scale at which the measurements could potentially become a lot more interesting than off of an individual developer.
That's great.
Just
throw them in. Okay. Moira, Robert.
Of what that partnership would look like.
Well, I don't know.
It sounds very generous.
Our executive directors, but I'm pretty sure that they would be open to it. We're trying to figure out how to measure everything right now because we know that we're touching so much stuff. And so on every project, we're trying to develop metrics. But maybe we're not developing the right metrics. Because we're not sort of scientifically oriented by nature.
Yes, please.
Thank you. So sometimes I think that what's happening is that we've got decisions being made all the time, right? Based on a whole bunch of assumptions that don't necessarily hold. And sometimes we have data and we measure all these things, but we don't have models that make sense of the data so that we can actually understand causal relationships so that if we do this, then this will happen or this might happen or this might happen. So it's not just about the data, but it is about, like the panel was saying, was about making sense of the data as well. So that is the part where learning comes in, right? Like in trying to understand, what's gonna happen if I do something and why. And if I know that, then I know what I can do or what we collectively can do to, make a difference and make things better. But I think that the part of the problem is this progression, that there's like the decision, the learning that has to happen in order to know what decision we need to make, then there's the implementation that based on what we learned, then there's like, is there success or not? Like, so I think that it would really help to think of all these stages and what we need to support that progression of stages of, understanding, action, evaluation, and so on. And so we need tools and approaches that go with those tools because as we were discussing, the tools by themselves don't do anything. It's the relationship among each. All of us and with the tools and that innovation happens. But I want to bring in, and as I think that's been my theme throughout this whole workshop, is the politics of it and the political aspect of it.
We're academics.
Run away!
Why?
I know, but we're
some of us are academics
insisting.
Of politics.
That's true.
But this is
your
why
question
I'm
is directed at Ken.
But this is why I'm insisting on this aspect, because it's something that we continuously say, models are not neutral. Like, they really are not. They represent our values, what we see, what we decide to not see or not consider. Those are political value decisions. And I think that we've got to recognize that dimension. When we think of, when you were describing, the optimization, how you use optimization, it's great, but maybe that space is not where we need to be. Maybe we need to like be in a completely different space, right? Maybe we're in a local optima, but there might be a global optima that we've got to look for, right?
Definitely.
So, or other kinds of local optima. Yeah. So this, you know, I think that we, and then even when we talk about, well, the political will is not there, well, maybe we need to create it. We are an agent in that, right? So I just want to bring that as something that I think is a necessary ingredient that we as academics even have to deal with. And I just, you know, I bring this up also because of, you know, again, like trying to give direction to NSF on like what kinds of things, you know, we should be dealing with and addressing.
I think what I'm hearing you say too is something that another thing that's kind of missing. Well, it's not missing. It depends on the individuals, but it's not like programmatically incorporated, which is how do we teach people to become change agents? And that includes how do we teach academics to be change agents and be comfortable as we go through transitions management. So as we're managing these transitions,
right,
inevitably there's going to be discord, and inevitably somebody steps up and pitches the change, and frequently they're not very popular politically.
Yeah.
And so teaching that resilience in our behavior.
We talked a little bit about this over the course of the workshop, but convincing people you're right, people in this room, is itself going to be hard to do.
Yeah.
I have a colleague, I like to tell a story. I have a colleague in Ag Econ who's a superstar modeler. He's on IPCC. He's done this extraordinary modeling work where he's taken hydrologic models and he's integrated them with econometric models of energy and food, all right? And it's mind-boggling what he's done. And you ask him about the issues you raised, and this is literally what he says. He says, you know, if I get the model right, everything else will just take care of itself.
No.
Well, I know he's not. But that, he deeply believes that, right? So, you know, I don't think we're going to resolve that. I think we do need to work towards some sort of a convergence of, in attitudes of that sort. I don't know how to do it.
I just want to point out too, because Tony has a discussion session
too.
Yeah.
But is traders, right? Like if we're training traders, and this is a construct that Anthony and I have been talking about for a little while now, but if you can get people trained, and they don't necessarily need to be the academic, although they could be, but we just need people who, in sort of an anthropological analogy, who can stand at the intersection of different cultures and help make that transition so that trading can occur. And I think that could be across the spectrum of people involved, including the academics, in such a way that the scientist who wants to keep himself entirely supposedly objective or whatever, can, you know, that knowledge is translated to the trader who mediates that space as somebody who's knowledgeable about how this space is mediated. I never see that in policy or politics, where they call this expert in this one kind of water sort of situation, but I'm like, why don't you also bring in academics who handle decision making and study that so they can give advice
right.
to politicians about how their decision is structured and facilitate that